when the Buddha set out on his quest for liberation, he did so based in a feeling, and that feeling was seems to have been something like fear. When, as a young man, in his mid-20s, he encountered for the first time in his life three what were called heavenly messengers, or signs of what life consists of. He saw an old person, a sick person, and a corpse. And so from the beginning of his inquiry into what's happening and why it hurts so bad, he said, oh, there's this at the heart of it, old age, sickness, and death, that can't be avoided. So he got, in seeing these three things, that he went out, and when he saw them, he was with his charioteer, so he was with his driver, as it were. So a working class person who was quite familiar with these things. Gotama had grown up quite privileged, hadn't seen a sick person, an old person, or a corpse yet. And no worries. And we'll tell you. And so he asks his driver, you know, in each case, what is this? And said, oh, that's an old person. Could this happen to me? And the driver says, you know, if you're lucky enough to live long, it certainly will. Likewise with sickness, and then inevitably so with death, right? This happens to everyone eventually. And so this is the beginning of the whole system, is this person noticing for the first time these things that are intrinsic to living existence, right? Old age, sickness, and death are built in to having a body, to being, right? And clearly, they're built into to every aspect of the system. So all the animals, the same thing. Inanimate things, right? A mountain at a certain point is born, you know, is worn away and dies. And all sorts of systems, family systems come into being. Age, sicken, die. Social systems come into being. Entire nation states and governments come into being based on conditions. And then they get old, they sicken, they pass away. And maybe the, you know, on a cosmic scale, like the planet itself, right? Ages, sickens, passes away, changes its form radically, eventually. So with this as the beginning of the inquiry, the Buddha goes on and does his whole practice. He realizes liberation. The moment of his realizing and becoming free of suffering is very much about this same thing. He has an insight into he has two different insights, really, into karma, into how things change based on conditions, how lifetimes progress, how our experiences are dependent on our actions. He sees all of this in liberating detail very, very, very clearly. And so embedded in both his search and the answer that he found is something about change. It's something about how everything is transitory. And that the sense of that transitoriness is both the question and, in the end, the answer. He senses it once, and there's fear, right? In the moment of his insight, he senses it again, and there's liberation. So contact with this thing is both the, to jump traditions, the alpha and the omega of the path. When he goes to do his very first teaching, he teaches his five friends he'd been practicing with. And he gives them a teaching on the Four Noble Truths that we've talked about many times, the nature of suffering based in attachment. He doesn't actually say anything about transitoriness or change or impermanence. He describes, he talks more about seeing and understanding suffering, seeing and understanding its cause being attachment. And he describes the path to get there. He says that it's possible to end attachment and therefore end the suffering, and this is how to do it. doesn't mention impermanence, but at the end of the text, after he has given this basic teaching, one of the five friends has an initial liberating experience. And the way that he announces that liberating experience is he announces the phrase, all conditioned things arise and pass away. That's his lion's roar, as the Zen tradition would say. All conditioned things, so everything that came into being based on a set of actions somehow, set of conditions, passes away. That's his insight, and that's the liberating insight. And the Buddha is so thrilled at this. He says, you know, he exclaims, Kundanya sees, Kundanya sees. Kundanya was the monk's name. He understands this. So there's this list called the three characteristics. And it's a list that is three qualities that are totally interwoven. And that that in a sense are a map for inquiry into our experience. We want to understand our life. We want to understand why things happen or what we should do or how to be more at peace with things. It says this, an inquiry into these things is part of it. And the three are, in Pali, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. They're translated as impermanence, suffering, and not self. For impermanence, I'm going to weave in and out of also using the word transitory, which has a different sense. Things are not just not permanent, they also are really quite changing. Next week I'll talk about suffering. Maybe we're always talking about suffering, but next week we'll talk about it directly. And I like the translation unsatisfactoriness for dukkha instead of suffering. And the week following we'll talk about the nature of the self in relation to those things. But the first one is always impermanence. And there's the sense, like Kundanya, that it's the doorway to insight. Seeing that things change is the doorway to insight. Why would this be the case? So here's our practice. And so many of the contemplative practices, the observation practices, boil down to, in a sense, observe things as they happen. Right, I'm watching my breath, here's the in-breath, the out-breath, a new in-breath, a new out-breath. I'm watching my body, and now there's an achy sensation, now there's a pleasurable sensation. I'm watching my energy, now I kind of have high energy, now I have kind of low energy. Part of what mindfulness, or the practice of awareness, consists of is simply tracking what's happening moment to moment. Now I'm engaged in listening. Now my stomach gurgles and I'm a little hungry. And my attention turns, or my state shifts to a state of being a little hungry. And then my state shifts to being a little sleepy. And then I get interested in something and my state shifts to interest or bright engagement. And as we practice, we get stronger and stronger in this, like the muscle of this noticing. And the grain of the noticing becomes finer. Right? I notice that even though I basically feel pretty good right now, and I basically felt pretty good a minute ago, how I feel right now, and my whole experience right now, is subtly different than a minute ago. And that starts to register kind of, I think initially on a sort of subconscious or you know, not quite cognitive level, as we're practicing. You know, tons of practice is just like wrestling with the crazy thoughts and my stories that are going on, and there's self-doubt, and then am I doing it right, and then I'm worried about work, and so I wrestle with worries, and then I notice worries, and I try to come back. There's a lot of sort of trying to kind of right the ship for a while in the beginning of practice. And by beginning, I mean, you know, I don't know, 10 or 20 years for some, or lifetimes, you know, if you believe that direction. Who knows, right? Sometimes it's just like that, even for folks with lots of experience. But after some time, we just start to get fluent a little bit with noticing things. And it's like, oh yeah, You know, even noticing the mind is a mess. You're like, oh, right now the mind is a mess. Lots of thoughts, one thought after another thought. And you're just like, look, the thoughts keep changing. Amazing. You know, where do they come from? Who knows? You know, it's like, oh, look, I'm a cuckoo bird again. Which is, that's my one of my recent sort of favorite technical terms for what comes over me sometimes. And you're like, oh, look, it's cuckoo bird. I'm like, okay. Spinning, worried, and what's going to happen? And you start to just notice. Some states you like them. Oh, I'm calm, I'm happy, or I'm excited. Some states you don't like it. I'm dull, I'm sleepy, I'm worried. But they just keep changing. So your practice is to notice that. As we practice noticing this, we start to take it not just as a psychology, like, oh, look, my feelings are changing moment to moment, but we start to see it as a property of living systems. So, you know, my whole family system kind of breathes, right? There's a day of, like, bright connection, and then there's a day of kind of dull nyickiness, right? And it moves, you know. There's a day where work feels, you know, inspiring and opening. There's a day that work feels sort of onerous and heavy. And everything does this, right? And you start to notice, oh, all of these things that I thought of as consistent, like I go to work, it's the same every day, or I see my friend and they're the same person as before, or I wear the same old shirt as before. Although multiple people noticed, actually, today that the Throwback Thursday baby picture that I posted of myself at probably like, you know, 2 years old or something, I'm wearing nearly this identical shirt in it. You know, I have a lot more hair in the picture. It was the early 70s. And I spent most of my childhood with a huge poof of like, you know, yeah. And some of the pictures, my sweetie and I were looking at baby pictures. I like them. And some of the pictures, you know, one of them, she actually said, what were they thinking? You know? Like, just like what a hairdo. It wasn't just big, it was like lopsided. It was sculpted in the style of the day, you know, in a way that's really, wow, 1972 was a time. So yeah, and some things, you know, seem to stay the same, right? Oh, same fashion sense over 45 years of life. But of course it's not true, right? There was a whole period in my, you know, when I was like 15, I wouldn't have been caught dead in a shirt like this because it was black turtlenecks, you know, era. Right? It was 1985 and, you know, I wouldn't wear this. Like, what am I, a country singer? You know? Now I would be like, hey, I look like a country singer. But, you know, back in the day. And so the inquiry says, apply this lens of discernment to anything you think is consistent, right? And what you're going to start to uncover is like the illusion of constancy in things, right? We come back to this same room, you know, every week. And there's the sense, probably very subconscious, that like, well, it's a building, right? It's going to keep being here. And I just assume when I'm coming over, it never occurs to me that like the studio might not be there when I show up for satsang. But of course, you know, right now there's a fire raging through lots of places. There's a particular fire that was that's raging around Big Sur right now, really burning a lot of territory, and it has come very close to Tassajara Zen Center, which had a very close encounter with fire some years back. Inspiring, you know, heroic Zen action from a few monks that you can read about in a really cool book called Fire Monks. It's kind of the story of these, like, five, I think, kind of people who stayed behind when the fire surrounded the valley to defend the Zendo and the buildings and that. So, you know, Zen makes heroes. It has that kind of tone to it a little bit. You know. But we assume the building's going to be here. But, you know, of course, that assumption is wrong at its base, right? like any given week, the probability is fine. Like, okay, it's a decent probability. But the thing that causes suffering in it, the reason that this is a characteristic of existence to be reflected on, is not that probably it will be there. It's that some part of us has hooked a teeny little bit of certainty about existence into things continuing to be the way I expect them to be. Right? There's a little thread of like, you know, things are okay because continuity. Right? And one of the things that practice does is it starts to trouble that water. As I was thinking about talking about this tonight, I was thinking about, as I always do nowadays, kind of global, like, political systems. Not to mention that an unnamed member of our community told me how much they loved when we veer into geopolitics. And so they were like, more geopolitics, please. And I'm like, who asks for that? It's great. But people do. People do. So I don't know how far I'm going to veer, but think about it as a quality of living systems. And what we get is not only that big systems, like I said, nation states and you know, whole kind of constructions come and go, and we can notice them come and go. Studying history is actually a part of this inquiry, right? A good historian, like, doesn't get complete, you could tell me if I'm wrong, get completely attached to, like, one era, right? Like oh, you know, fin de siècle, it was the best. It was the best, right? But, you know, but you don't get attached to it as much because you're like, well, but, you know, the court of Genghis Khan, it was also pretty good. And, you know, wherever there's been so much that you're like, oh, it really does change, right? And it gives you a certain perspective to be less attached, perhaps. But we can also think about not just the fact that things change, but what we do in response to it. And one of the things, if I think about kind of the political world, there's these words, like conservative and liberal, right? To define kind of different basic or like core attitudes in relation to existence. And stripped down almost to like just the literal meaning of those words, the conservative, and it's been like this historically a little bit in some wings of conservatism, right? You could generalize it to be like, in the face of incessant transitoriness or change, the unreliability of things, the right thing to do is to try to preserve as much good stuff as possible, right? To slow down the course of change by holding on to things that you value, right? Don't change so fast. Might be a kind of conserving principle. So that's just one possible response to change, right? Another response, maybe on the liberal end, you know, would be to have the idea that we can actually change things for the better. So we get in there and we don't mind that things are changing. We actually like that they're changing because they used to be bad. And we think that we can change them for the better. So we're in there tinkering, right? Let's fix it. Let's do it differently as a kind of liberal model. Oh, change. And I wonder if there are other models, you know. And particularly, the thing that the Buddha and the Dharma seems to be pointing to is neither of those, right? Both of those, in a way, are responses. They're almost like emotional responses to the reality of change. Neither of them relax in the presence of change. Neither of them actually say, oh, look, this is just how systems work. Or if they do, they then maybe start there and then go on to what one should do about it. Therefore, one should preserve something, or therefore one should change in a good direction. And in that sense, both of those stances are basically ethical stances, right? Right? They're action stances. But they're not wisdom stances. Right? They're not. Neither one is more true than any other. They're just choices, probably unconscious, for how best to respond to conditions, to circumstances changing. So then I think as we inquire, part of what we can feel into is what happens in me when I set aside any particular fixing or plan for how to feel more comfortable in the face of change, and just let in the reality of it, right? So like, you could choose anything, you know, we could choose something that we often get attached to, like another person, say a dear friend. And, you know, rather than trying to, say, you know, solve the problem of transitory friendships by, like, you know, creating this, like a brilliant, I don't know, co-housing development where you get to live with your friends and just, like, get them. You got them, you know. And they're not going anywhere, you know. Which is a beautiful thing to build. It's, you know, it's on our minds. It's one of the things we want, really value in terms of a way to live. But the inquiry would rather than that say, oh, this friend I love so much, feel, you know, not taking away anything from the love for them or the delight in being with them and wanting to live with them and all that, and they're changing, because everything is, and the friendship is changing, as everything does. And so, noticing that, something else becomes possible besides the, like, preserve the good thing in the face of, you know, the juggernaut of change, or, you know, tinker with it until it gets better and better and better, which also sort of resists reality, right? It resists entropy, it resists death, actually. Right? Both forms of reaction are afraid of death. The one that says, I can constantly improve this thing, and the one that says, stop, just stop the things where they are, right? Both don't look squarely at the natural rising and falling of things. So then the inquiry simply, in a way, says, let this in as a reality. Investigate it. Get curious about it. Is there anything around that doesn't change? And all of the things that do change, how do I feel about that? What do I do about that inside? How do I maneuver in my life to shelter me from the reality of this? And then what happens if I see that clearly? And it doesn't mean don't do anything. It doesn't mean like, oh, you know, I love this person, but I'm not going to get married because, you know, that's like resisting the natural order of things changing. Right? It doesn't mean that. I totally got married. I resisted the natural. I'm like, ooh, you're great. Let's pin it down. You know, let's put a ring on it. Right? Which is a great, like, you like it, get attached to it, and it will stay. And it's the, you know, it's the forever and after, ever after. Yeah, you know, that thing that does that doesn't exist. It's that myth. Ever after, for happy ever after. And it's like, well, maybe, you know. So then seeing things in their reality of change. And then as we do, what happens? Why is that so liberating? Why is that actually the cornerstone of insight? So we'll pause there for now. Let's just sit for a minute or two. Let it settle, and we can kind of, we could even come back into the inquiry now in a kind of sensate way, without trying to see anything particular. Just take a minute and notice things changing. Just letting it settle. So, I'm just opening up the inquiry. Anything from your practice or that you're curious about or that you know in yourself around this. What do you do or how does it land in you, this the transitoriness of things? Sir.
A question out of your talk tonight. And I want to try to word this somewhat carefully. What is it like, what does it look like or sound like to try to get a social theory out of a contemplative tradition preoccupied by the problem of liberation?
What does it look like to try to get a social theory out of the contemplative tradition preoccupied with liberation? The first thing that comes to me is the last part of that sentence, which is that the contemplative tradition preoccupied with liberation. So the liberation part is, in a sense, like the aim or the underlying intent of the technology, right? And so to think about the social, I would think about, I could look at a social system, say, and ask, what is the underlying intent or like the core impulse driving that system, right? What's the motor of that thing? And that underlying intent, I think, will determine what are the important elements to look for or see in it, right? So for the Buddha, the intent being liberation, And what he comes up with is, look at, kind of understand the system in this way. Oh, this is how it works, right? So it's a little bit analytical. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is how things work. If you want to be liberated, part of that is understanding how things work, right? And that's going to lead to the next step, which is letting go, right? Once you see that things change, even though you think they're consistent, you don't cling so much because you see that resistance is futile. And, you know, you let go, right? So if I look at a social system, and I say, what's the underlying kind of goal of that social system? You know, if I look at the, let's say, the Democratic Party, why not, right? One of its underlying MOs, it seems from this distance to be, is self-preservation, right? It's to continue getting people elected and to continue to be a powerful organization that gets to determine policy, yada, yada, yada. So with that, let's just simplify that down to the one word, power. So if power is its basic MO, then we would expect to see actions that are attempting to give rise to that. And then the last thing I'll say about that is I think that there's a challenge sometimes when we forget to look for the underlying MO and we think that all systems should have the same aim. So then I might say, the Democratic Party as constituted is not particularly liberative. And one, hopefully I think the correct answer would be, of course it's not silly, it's not trying to be. So that make sense with your question?
It does. If we have time for a quick follow-up,
go.
The question would be, what's the parallel that you're striking, if you are indeed striking it, maybe I'm wrong, between the project of the liberation of the individual, or if you prefer, the apparent individual?
We'll get there.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this idea of a goal or telos of a social system.
Yeah.
Right? Are you, in fact, trying to create a parallel between those things?
Nice. What if we did, just for fun, and we took the intention, the core ideology, as it were, of the liberative search, like it's possible to be free of suffering by understanding the system and stopping trying to push the river, right? If we took that intention into a social system, we might say, you know, okay, how then, this is the algebraic equation, right? There's one x and then the four known factors. You know, if letting go is to liberation, as in the individual, is what to liberation in a city, right? And then we would say, okay, if my goal for Oakland, our fair city, is liberation, what actions or structures should I set in place to make that possible, right? And then if those actions are essentially the conditions that create, or the actions that create the conditions for seeing clearly and letting go of trying to fix things, one of those conditions we know, for instance, is safety, right? Or freedom from basic physical danger and want. Maslow's hierarchy, right? So if I wanted Oakland to become liberated, a good first step would be to feed everybody and keep them safe, right? So then I can go sort of leftist progressive on this and say, you know, basic income, yada, yada, whatever, social safety net. But that would be a first thing. And then I could say, now, how do I encourage people to, in a certain way, be less ambitious or be less fixated on a certain kind of gaining something and get people to be, you know, at ease and content with how things are? And that might mean something like, you know, destroying ideological capitalism. So, you know, we can work on that. But that's where I go with.
Thank you so much.
Your question, yeah. It's a good one.
This is not really how things are organized in political units that have a Buddhist culture. I'm sort of imagining places I've traveled.
Right.
Or studied. And Sri Lanka or Myanmar, where you've practiced, doesn't have this tone. It seems like there's a firewall.
It doesn't.
For some good reasons.
Or very difficult to overcome reasons, you know. In the late 60s, as Thailand, late 60s, early 70s, as Thailand was trying to leap from being a slow agricultural kind of subsistence country into, you know, the juggernaut of, I've used that word twice now. It refers to a holy festival in Orissa in on the east coast of India, where two small deities would be dragged in a ginormous heavy wooden car from one temple to another once a year on their auspicious day, in an extraordinary, like, complex ritual that takes up the entire town. And it's called the Jagannath Festival. And it's based in the movement of these deities in these huge wooden carts that fill the entire street with massive, massive wheels, and it takes huge amounts of people pulling them, devotees, to drag them clanking across these massive things, very, very, very heavy, a juggernaut, unstoppable, and occasionally a devotee, overcome with ecstatic trance, will throw themselves in front of the wheels as a kind of offering to the divine. So that's the juggernaut, just a total aside, Wikipedia aside on the word. But what's that?
That word.
I always wondered what that word
is. No, totally, right? That, there you go. There you go. There you go. Oh, darn.
Thailand.
In late 60s, early 70s, Thailand was going to leap into sort of the capitalist, tourist, manufacturing kind of future. And the Thai government actually asked the Buddhist monastic system formally to quietly stop teaching about contentment. Wow. Right? That one just takes 3 seconds to sink in, and then you're just like, oh.
Explains a lot.
Dear. Right? Mm-hmm. Right? No, they really pushed for it. They actually tried to reform the monastic curriculum. This is about educational, you know, design. And one of the prominent monks there, who's a grandfather teacher to me. I studied with one of a few of his students, named Buddhadasa, who not randomly wrote a book called Buddhist Socialism. He was a radical monk of the time, and he was in contact with the leftist movements elsewhere. You know, this is like 68, 69. He actually spearheaded a movement to push back against the government's request and say that contentment was integral to the Buddhist message, that letting go of want and craving was the message and couldn't be excised from the system. So yeah, the government's, you know, it's very difficult to run a virtuous government. You know, it's very, very difficult. And so there you go, you know. But you do see this in organizations. You see it in the monastic sangha, you know, choices made in many organizations of different kinds, non-profit-y kind of organizations, you know, to essentially, you know, value substance over power. And it's very hard to stay in power if you do so. Another anecdote about that is that when Buddhism arrived in Tibet, Tibet was actually a ginormous empire that governed most of China. And it was, like many of the Chinese empires, it was a massive empire with a massive army, and a whole complex sort of Himalayan-based kingdom that stretched all the way up through what's now Mongolia. And when mythically Padmasambhava, but when visiting teachers probably from northwest India, Kashmir, Jammu and Kashmir, reached the Tibetan monarchy and converted, or in the process of converting the nobles in Tibet, in this empire, to Buddhism, there was an advisor that literally advised, if you take up this religion that holds as its heart compassion and kindness and nonviolence and letting go and non-attachment, the empire will fall. And they were right. Within one generation of conversion, the empire had shrunk all the way down to being just the Tibetan plateau. Because they started passing out the message of not going on further wars of conquest. It takes a lot to defend an empire like that. A lot of constant battle, basically. They started to pull that in, and that was the end of the empire at that time. And I'm sure that causation was much more complex than that, kind of politically, but that's part of the story. So, yeah, so a bit there. Other thoughts? Everything's changing. Is that okay?
With you? In conversation
please.
With a friend years ago, it was like my tagline about change. It's like change. Often good, rarely easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So then what is it about it that's rarely easy? Like, why isn't it easy? That's the liberation question.
Yeah, it is. There's always something that, you know, whether it's a change in job or moving, or there's always some level of difficulty.
Yeah.
To change.
What's the difficulty? Is it that I like so much where it's been, and I'm afraid that it'll be worse?
Yeah, I mean it depends, but there's always something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Having to look for a place, or going to job interviews. There's all of these things, extra stuff that happens around change.
Yep. Yep, right. So in between bigger, you're talking about kind of bigger life changes, of course. In between those, I get lazy in a certain way because things seem to be consistent, and so they don't take as much effort, right? And so then I think that's how things should be, right? So I'm resting in a certain way in the illusion of continuity, even though, like, you know, you walk the dog, it's not quite the same every day. And one day it could be very different, you know. But most days it's the same. And so we kind of sleepwalk through it in a certain way. So one of the breath instructions that I didn't give, but is lovely in relation to this inquiry, is to imagine that you're, if you want to externalize it, watching somebody pass away. Or if you're braver and want to internalize it, imagine that you're watching yourself pass away. And you watch each breath as if it's this body's last breath. The way that, like, if you really loved someone and you were bedside and you were really with them and you weren't going to miss it, like, it's important, right? You're just with their breathing, you love them, there's care. And each breath could be it, could be the last one. And so you can practice yourself like that, which is a little bit the, like, what would wake us up from the idea that in between the big changes, it's actually kind of normal, mm-hmm. right, and stable, when actually it's not, right? It could always be a big change at any instant. So then the practice is actually not to indulge in the sense of continuity and only be reminded about change when the big things happen, but to be like, well, yeah, you know, every moment I deal with the world being radically different than a moment ago, if I'm sensitive, right?
And then to be okay with that.
And then to be okay with that, right?
Otherwise, it's like, could be a constant state of
terror. Yes, yes. So there's a sequence of classical insights that one has on the path to breaking through. And they're essentially kind of psycho-emotional states. It's called the stages of insight, if you want to look it up. 16 kind of things that one tends to see roughly in this order. And they start with things like seeing change and seeing the appearance of things. Everything's like appearing as if brand new every moment. And then a later one, like we did in the exercise today, was seeing things dissolve. And, oh, everything I see or sense or feel, it's gone almost as soon as it appears because it changes so fast. And there's all these layers of seeing this. And then there's three painful insights right in the middle of the sequence that are called fear, disgust, and misery. I you know, hesitate ever telling people that this is what one can look forward to as one becomes wise. But it's actually just the natural response to seeing what's real, right? Then the first one is fear. Like, oh, if this is really true, and the insight is basically that moment when it goes from, wow, everything is just flickering in and out of existence, everything is just disappears as soon as you see it, that hits your heart, and something in you goes, whoa. And that's an insight. It's considered very liberative, but it's the insight called fear. So, not all fear is that insight. Right? All sorts of fear is just like trauma playing out, or appropriate fear, meaning like something dangerous is happening and I'm afraid. But this level of it is a wisdom manifestation that says, oh, I'm seeing clearly now in a way that I wasn't before. Yikes. You know? And then the next ones are like, what the heck am I going to do about that? You know, how do I be okay with that? And it's a little process before you come out the other side.
That I was experiencing both in our earlier sit with the, it was a, even though it was a so simple thing of experiencing the breath as arising and fleeting, it was, the emotional tone was really connected to something that I experienced around change in like larger ways in my life, where it was a just, I hear what you're saying, fear, but it was more of like a poignancy, almost.
Nice.
It's like fear and love in a some kind of sad, awesome sandwich.
Yes. Yes. Totally. Totally. And this is not entirely an unpleasant state, isn't the poignant?
Right. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard.
Right.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And that was connecting to talking about accepting change, I often tell myself a story about myself not changing in ways that I wish to.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting to see the ways in which that's also not true. Like,
yeah,
the feeling of being stuck, just in the same way of, like, fearing change.
Yes.
But the fearing the not change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going anywhere with that. But
you certainly are going somewhere with it. Because you're getting nods of like, oh, yeah. You know, I know that very well. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. In both cases, I'm not perceiving reality accurately. Right. But the poignant is really beautiful. And I think it's a, you know, fear is a sort of intense version of that insight. Poignant, I think you're right in saying, it's related to the same insight. It's almost like it's a little more mature or worldly in a certain way. Like, you do have some wisdom around change. Like, you've seen enough change to not be just like, ah, but to be like, oh, it's meaningful that things pass away and we feel it, but you also, you know, you're not in denial of it. We wouldn't feel the poignancy if we were just like, ah! So I think it's actually kind of a beautiful state, you know, that poignant feeling. Yeah, and I think that's a feeling that, you know, the Buddhist tradition would kind of lump under compassion as a sort of frame. Yeah. I heard over here something, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess what I'm curious about is that which sees change transitory. Because it seems like if that which is seeing is of a transient nature,
yeah,
it's not really going to have any real degree of perspective.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when I was a kid, I would look at the cars on the opposite side of the freeway.
Hmm.
And I go, why they get to go so fast over there?
Nice, yeah, totally.
And it just seemed like they were zipping right by. And on our side, we're not really going all that much.
Yeah, totally.
It seems slower.
Nice.
So with that relative perspective, you're
such
incapable.
A great example about perception, right?
I was hoping it'd go over well, but I just it's something where you can't really gain any real perspective, and so. It leads me to inquire within myself and in the group as well about the nature of that which sees if somehow it can land in a space that is unmoving.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's really just a question to investigate experientially, right?
I love not having an answer to that question. In a way, I'm content just with the question.
You know, and it's such an important question. It's almost, in a certain way, the question. We'll talk about it in 2 weeks, the nature of the self or the witness. But basically, the major traditions have interestingly related but diametrically opposed answers to the question. So Vedanta says, notice that everything changes, but there's a witness that doesn't change. That's you, that's God, that's it, right? The Buddha would say, notice that everything changes, notice the part that perceives the change, ask if that too is consistent, look closely at that, and see if you can actually see it being consistent. Then let's talk, right? And but the traditional way that has come down is that the Buddha says, even that is not consistent. And one way of thinking about that would be, are you always in contact with it? Or like when you're sleepwalking and you're not actually conscious of it, is it still happening? And so that's the meditation. Which requires something very subtle, which is that you maintain awareness through distraction. Right? This is subtly, bizarrely, really hard to do. It says, you have to somehow be conscious of the times when you're not conscious. Right? So that you can notice if consciousness itself comes and goes.
So that's
just go. Smoke that and see where it goes. Yeah. And the very way that you ask the question is a very classic inquiry, particularly from like the Advaita tradition. So like Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, Sri Ramana Maharshi, those folks would ask the question in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice. Nisargadatta particularly would. If you want to take a look at the book, I am that.
Yes, I read.
You know, yeah, totally. Yes. So that's where you're hanging out.
Yeah,
right now.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right on. Anything else? Nicole, you want to?
Well, kind of connecting some dots in a way for me. I play a little mindfulness game when I'm in the car on the freeway, which is to sort of soften my gaze, and not too much, but a little bit. And kind of let all the peripheral stuff flow in and out. It's kind of a wonderful exercise because then you actually start to feel how fast you're really moving. Because when your focus is a little ahead of the car, you're kind of like, but when you start letting it all come in, it's, and then I find
this is really nice to do in the passenger seat, right? Just saying, I'm sure you're very safe.
Or
but.
Whatever. I find myself in that, I don't know, blissful, painful, tearful realization of kind of like, it's just all passing by, just that whole sensation of that constant change. It's magnified, it's kind of cool.
Mm.
But coming back to what you said, I feel like part of what's so painful about those big changes is the fact that the dominant narrative in our culture, I think, is really that you're supposed to have control.
Mm-hmm.
So like, whether it's changing something about yourself, or it's keeping things how you want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Accepting change and accepting the flow is not what we're fed that we're supposed to be doing.
Absolutely.
So there's a swimming upstream that's happening, I think.
Yes. Yes.
So I'd love to know what you have to say about that.
I have really nothing to add other than that's, as I understand it, exactly the point. It's very much that. And the Buddha said, following the Dharma is to go against the stream of culture. So that's known, right? That if you actually do this, you will be undoing or resisting that kind of core ideology in our culture, right? That we should be able to fix it, accomplish it, change it the way we want, control it, that kind of thing. And in a certain way, like, all of that's not bad, you know? Like, the sense that we have agency is important, right? If your diet is terrible and you have the resources to eat better, you can, right? If you're, you know, we do have some responsibility also to act in our situation, but the destructive part of that is that belief system you're pointing to. Right, that like, oh, it should be under our control, et cetera, rather than, you know, we have a say in how things turn out, but that say is only part of what conditions what happens, you know, and it's not guaranteed. And the non-guaranteedness, I think, is the thing that our culture really doesn't like. And the way that it does like it, of course, is that it really likes you to keep buying stuff. So it does want you to actually recognize impermanence, you know, in the sense of like, you know, everything needs to be updated constantly and wears out and needs more. And, you know, somehow every time I try to watch a movie on Amazon, it tells me I need to reinstall Microsoft Silverlight. And I'm like, stop. This is one sort of illusion of continuity I would like to maintain. But yeah, the reflection that I'm liking in what you're saying is to be awake to a message that we get fed about this and how misleading that message could be. Yeah. Right on. So that's our time for tonight. It's a pleasure to chat with you, hang out. Next week we'll talk about some of the implications of this in relation to things being dukkha or unable to provide permanent security, satisfaction. And then we'll apply all of that, all that heavy business to the nature of the self itself in a couple weeks. So see you at any of those. As always, we're fully celebrating the gift economy here. And what that really means is that you're invited to contemplate the impermanence of your resources. and knowing the ever-flowing nature of them, to make a choice out of enthusiasm, in all seriousness, to support something that you value in a way that that enables the juggernaut to keep rolling along, crushing all those in its path. With compassion, of course. And two small divine beings riding on it, whatever that means, metaphorically. It's a pleasure to see you. Take good care out there. See you soon.